Think of all the books that have shaped who you are. Now, let's advance the conversation. In this podcast, I'll dig into topics that affect how you see the world by talking with authors who write about them. This is Cap Radio Reads. I'm Donna Epidone. Today, you'll hear my conversation with Brenda Hillman and Blas Falconer about a poetry anthology called Why to These Rocks. In 1971, a group of poets gathered in the Olympic Valley to hone their craft and share their work. That tradition continues in this 50th anniversary year. To mark the occasion, the group, now known as the Community of Writers, has published a collection of poems called Why to These Rocks that captures the magic of the gatherings and features poems written during the course of the sessions. I spoke with Brenda Hillman, director of the poetry program, and Blas Falconer, who is an instructor at the workshop, about the history of the annual sessions and about the role of poetry in our lives. I was curious whether the initial class of poets in 1971 was inspired by poetry movements in the Bay Area.
There were a lot of East Coast poets that were participating in this. Charles Wright, of course, was living in the West. It was more the place that was defining the poetry culture, so that whoever would gather, and I think this is one thing that's really still true of the gathering there, Donna, is that the place and the quality of the interaction that's defined by the place tends to gather and make its community and make it the community felt. So to our complete astonishment, last summer when we gathered on Zoom because of the pandemic, we were intensely remembering the place, but we were still able to bring this feel of the community that had been so, I would say, marinated or something over 50 years, thanks to the amazing staff and, of course, the amazing staff poets that we're able to bring together. So it is a place-oriented event, conference, but it's also deeply spiritually connected to the process-oriented work that gets done there.
Yeah, I first attended the workshop in 2012, and I had been writing for many years, but I had really just hit a dark note or a difficult time in my writing process. And so then I went to Olympic Valley and went to the conference. And one of the things that makes it really distinctive in my mind is that the focus is on work that's produced there. You know, it's not work that you've been kind of fussing over for a year or 5 years. It's something that you've written within the last 12 hours. And so there's a real spirit of kind of generosity and support, but also a kind of sense that, you know, you should try whatever you want to try. Do whatever you want to do. Do something you've never done before. So I don't think, you know, that's been really the kind of, I guess, the mode of the conference since Galway Canal envisioned it. And so I don't think it really attracts a particular school of poetry. It attracts everybody, and you can write however you want. And so, yeah, so I think that's one of the things that makes it special and draws us together to this place.
I saw the schedule, and there's a lot of blank time there. The groups are only meeting, the poets are only meeting for fairly short periods of time, not critiquing each other, just really listening to and absorbing each other's work. But there's so much free time, and that what I look at as free time, blank time on the schedule, but that's really writing time.
It is, and you need it. But another thing that makes this conference unique and really just fantastic is that everybody writes a new poem, not just the poetry participants, but staff as well. So it's very humbling. So, you know, so we would leave, you know, a craft talk and the staff would go home to write their poems, you know, and you go in the next day and say, I've only been working on this for a few hours, and you present it, but you need, anyway, so yes, you need a lot of that quiet time. And actually knowing that everybody else is, you know, quietly thinking over something, you know, and kind of, you know, working on a poem. It encourages you and kind of motivates you and inspires you to do the same. So, yeah.
Well, that's why it's called the community of writers, right? You really have that sense of community.
I'd like to second that and third that, and also just say that when the idea came up in the 80s, and I have to say, Galway didn't actually invent the idea. Bob had been doing it in other places for Bob Haas for a little while, but the thing that coalesced when Galway and Sharon Olds brought it to the Valley and this conference was that the whole community would be doing it, and the staff poets would be doing it together. And I think in the original idea, when it first came that poetry gatherings could be process oriented instead of looking at these, you know, older pieces, it seemed very fresh and original. And this is still going on. And as Blas is saying, there is no particular school, but it encourages you by its very by the very structure to try things you wouldn't try. And as a perfectionist and as somebody who waits for the first line of my poem, sometimes for 6 weeks or something, for me, it was agony for the first few years. And I was very crabby about it. You know, I would say, Galway, I'm going to cheat, you know, on Thursday, I'm going to pull out an old poem and you'll never know, you know, like the defiant daughter or something. But the fact is, you end up trying things that, and even if you're going to fall on your face, you invent stuff that you never would have, and you see by example. So that's what makes it such a joyful experience.
You threw in a few names that I want to ask you about. You also threw in a timeline that was a little bit different that I want to mention. You mentioned Galway, you mentioned Sharon Olds, and you mentioned Robert Haas. Can you give me a little bit, just a sentence about each one of them so we get acquainted?
Well, Galway Connell, bless him, was one of the great masters of poetry. And of course, he taught for many years at NYU and with Sharon Olds, who's another great master. Sharon still is, of course, American poetry, the intensity of the personal interior story being expressed for the lyric poem. They have been master teachers. And so Galway's spirit is still with us. Bob Haas, I can't say enough high praise for him. He's a really great American poet as well. And he joined that community of Galway and Sharon, I think in 1987 was his first year, or maybe it was 86.
Bob is a former U.S. Poet Laureate.
Yes, he is.
And you know him very well.
I do know him very, very well for 35 years. He's my beloved, and we're, and I have to say, an interesting thing for me was joining the staff poets on a regular basis and having to work out a personal relationship, which I don't think mostly has happened with poets there. But working out how you would work in space, you know, in space during the week. And that was really interesting. it's a different drama.
I want to ask you both, because you both teach poetry, you're poets, but you teach the craft as well. And not everyone does both. So I have to ask you a couple of questions. It sounds like dumb questions about poetry, but not everyone knows what you know. So I'm going to ask some of those questions and ask you to sort of walk us through a little bit. To me, I listen to poetry and I hear the musicality of it. I hear the music of it. Do you happen to know, historically, has poetry changed through the eras the same way music has changed? Is there a parallel of a sort?
So one thing that I've noticed, my students, I adore my students. They are just exceptional writers. They're inspiring. So talented. They motivate me quite a bit. But I noticed that many of them were only reading contemporary poetry, the latest book that's just come out, which is great. That's fantastic. They didn't have as much of a sense of the history of poetry, this kind of tradition that they were writing in. They didn't realize that they had been influenced by poets who came before them. So part of, you know, I feel like my responsibility is to give them a sense of that tradition. It's enriching, it's inspiring, you know, to realize that there are, you know, poets that have been writing for thousands of years all across the world, not just in, you know, California or the United States or in English even. And so I spent a great deal of time considering that history, and also looking at how contemporary poets are speaking to that history, because they are, and sometimes in ways they don't even know it. So maybe through, you know, the use of literary devices, sometimes through the use of diction or storytelling, or, you know, there's just so many ways. There are a number of different ways. So for example, last fall, I presented a number of modules working through kind of like many years of poetry, just giving them a sampling. And what I would say is, find your love. You know, if you, you know, if we're looking at medieval lit and you love this, you know, mode of writing during that period, I want you to dive deep into that. When we're looking at the Renaissance, if you love the sonnet, dive deep into that. If you, you know, if whatever it is that you love, I want you to kind of explore it. So my job is to maybe expose them, I feel, to this history and help them to find what they love and to pursue that, so that when they graduate, when they're done, they've moved on, they can continue seeking out that which they love within this art form. And then I did it again this spring. We looked at poetry and translation. Let's move beyond poetry that was originally written in English. Let's, you know, let's go around the world and see what concerns poets around the world have had, and what modes of writing they're employing, and what devices seem essential to what they have to say and what's happening around them. And so it's a big part of what we do, actually.
And Brenda, you were not at the very first sessions in 1971, but you were around poetry at that time. Was there a parallel that you were aware of with music of the time and poetry then?
Yes, indeed. And I want to completely agree with what Blas has just said, you know, about being an educator and educating people into the whole field, rather than just, you know, because the young poets or the emerging poet might just want to read, oh, the latest flavor of the month or whatever. But it's about seeing this 10,000-year history of expressivity, and not just in English, in many languages, many symbol systems. But just to your point, Donna, I think there are definite parallels in music, because, you know, sometimes, like, I'm a big fan of Bartok and Schoenberg, and, you know, and the atonal or polytonal modernist musicians, and jazz. I love jazz. And, you know, you're not going to get the straight lyric stuff all the time. And I think a lot of people do have to be educated into poetry, and not like taking your castor oil, but like seeing this rich, beautiful thing that happened in the 20th century. It's not just about Edward Arlington Robinson, you know, narrative nuggets. You know, it's about exploring experimental forms and polygrammatical forms. And, you know, Gertrude Stein is 100 years old, you know, and people act as if modernism is like, oh, what's this poet doing? You know, it's not even a sentence. And so I think education, you know, I always say this to my graduate students, like, that's why they call it education. But the thing about community of writers and our poetry week is that we don't have time. We have these craft talks, which are delicious, and we can do these sort of concentrated, breakfast bar type packets of information, but we don't have time to educate about the whole history of modernism. So we have to give them, you know, here are some tools. And I think it's very exciting to do it because we do have, we try to go for aesthetic variety in our staff poets and they're all really brilliant and they bring different things.
I noticed, Brenda, on your website, you have a list of recommendations. What should a person read in terms of poetry? And they're listed somewhat historically, and I think that might be why number one is Shakespeare's sonnet. Is that the reason for that collection, or is that number one for you?
For one thing, that list, I haven't updated it in quite some time, but I do emphasize, like Blas, just the historical sweep and range. And I think even though it's a very white, it's a very Western tradition that I was raised in, I do still really love grounding in romantic and symbolist 19th century poetry, as well as certainly, you know, 18th century greats. But love Shakespeare, you know, love Chaucer. But it's just that I think we do learn the tradition that we come from, and we widen it. You know, we widen it and we learn more, and it should be, as Blas says, international.
Blas, if I had to ask you for the top one or two on your list, what would they be? Who would they be?
Oh, that's too difficult of a question to answer, but I can recommend a poet who I think is I can recommend a book that I've read recently that I think I really admire. Rick Barrett's The Galleons. I couldn't possibly, you know, give you the top 10, but I will say that that book, I think it's extraordinarily good. So
let me ask you this. Was there a moment when you were reading earlier in your life, Blas, was there a moment when you were reading and you said, I love this stuff. This is poetry. I'm in. Do you remember who that was or what you were reading?
I remember the moment it happened. I was in a class at George Mason University. It was a contemporary poetry class, and we were reading the Poulin Anthology, the Contemporary American Poetry Anthology. And we read a poetry staff member's poems from the community of writers. It was Lucille Clifton. I read her poems and I just stopped because I couldn't believe that this was poetry. That this could be that, you know, poetry could sound like that and say these kinds of things. And I went out that day and bought my first poetry book, which was Quilting, her book of poetry, Quilting. And I read it over and over and over again. And I just kind of knew I wanted to do that for the rest of my life. Really, that was it. It was Lucille Clifton. Yeah.
So you knew as you were reading that you would also want to write?
I just knew I wanted to be a part of it. Yeah, I did. Yeah, I knew I wanted to write. I didn't think about publishing or anything like that, but I did want to write. Yeah. So
it must be so exciting for you to fast forward to this point and know that for these last few years, you have been a part of the community of writers, like the person who inspired you.
Absolutely. It's a bit indescribable, that feeling of coming to this place where I know Lucille inspired just so many hundreds and hundreds of poets
Lucille and I, we called her Miss Lucille at the Miss Lucille and I loved to rave about one of our first inspirations was Edna St. Vincent Millay. So when I was 9, my dad gave me a very, very big fat book, which is probably right behind my head right now, of Edna St. Vincent Millay. And she and Lucille and I loved Millay. Probably my very first poet was, I often say I had a huge crush on the courtiers of King James, because the sound of the King James Bible was my first crush, literary crush. And I read the Psalms especially, and Song of Solomon, and that sort of haunted, strange, gorgeous sound of that translation was my first crush, I think.
It's so interesting that poetry in that particular case, in those cases, poetry written in a different language translates so beautifully that it can touch so many people in that way. What is it about poetry in general, but specifically Psalms and Solomon? What was it that you heard? And I'm asking so that the rest of us can say, what would we listen for? What is it about a poem that makes it a good poem?
Gosh, well, Blas, you want to take that one? There are literally millions of answers to that. I mean, for me, poetry, the poetry that I love and that I fall in love with, always it as many varieties, like I mentioned Gertrude Stein. I love so many different kinds, like, you know, Western experimental women's eco-poetry, you know, spiritual weird poetry, political poetry that rants. I have so many different loves, but I feel always drawn to the fact that the inner and the outer invisible natures connect in a way that I haven't heard before. And as Blas describes, the encounter with Lucille's poetry, like, I didn't know you could do this. So there's a very large range of pretty good poetry at any one time in a culture. And there is now a very large range of quite good poetry. But the exceptional poetry that blows your head off, like, you know, for me, Dickinson, the British Romantics, you know, the modernists, you know, Harriet Mullen, I can still open Muse and Drudge and just go like, wow, this book blows me away. And I just still think that invisible and visible nature come together in poetry in a musical way that is original to the poem. That particular poem has to be said in that way. Whereas in a novel, you can often paraphrase. What's that novel about? It's about blah, 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 blah. A poem, you know, Wallace Stevens poems, you can't paraphrase, you know?
I love that answer, Brenda. It's impossible to answer the question, but I love what you said about the relationship between the inner and the outer worlds and that connection. And I think a lot of times for me, I understand the poem on a level that's not intellectual. Like I just understand it in a way that I just can't explain it. I just had this experience, Brenda, when I was looking at the anthology from the Community of Writers. I was looking through some of the poems, and there's this one poem by Shonda Feldman called Approaching the Fields. And I just was shaken. I was just so moved by it. It was so straightforward. And this anthology was put together to celebrate the Community of Writers. So it's filled with poems that were written or inspired by the workshop. And this is an extraordinary poem. And kind of the multiple ways that the poem was working just felt like a kind of truth in a way that is beyond a kind of fact. And then I looked and I was like, okay, these are some of the things that are happening that are making me love it. You know, these parallels that are being drawn between the mother's history and the mother's future, you know, so I could start to break it down, but really there was still some other mystery to it that made it like magic, truly magic. And so I don't know if I want to explain it thoroughly, you know, entirely or try to. I don't think I could, but
it sounds very emotional that you just have sort of a gut reaction to it that's warm and defies analysis.
Well, even like thinking about your comparison to music, it's like, would you explain like why does that music move you? You know, it would be very difficult. Or even an art piece, right? You stand in front of a work of art and you feel moved, but then if you start to break it down and say, well, the color and the shape, and you know, like then it starts to demystify it and it does, it's reductive in a way, right? So you can try to, but
it also expands what you understand about it because you're getting input from different people, you're seeing it maybe in a fresh way yourself, and it really can help you focus on something that you hadn't seen when you first read it or heard it.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And yeah, I guess you're absolutely right. It's very useful to kind of try and understand. It would be more accurate for me to say that it's inexhaustible, the ways in which you can kind of examine the piece.
What a beautiful word for that. Let's jump ahead and talk about the anthology. First of all, the title. Talk about Why to These Rocks? Why is the title, Why to These Rocks?
I think a phrase that gets absolutely accurately what we were just talking about, in a way, a sort of abstraction of language that gives a nugget of resonance that's both physical and mental and emotional. It gathers us to, you know, the Sierra as a place.
So the rocks in the title are the rocks of the Sierra.
Exactly. Well, they call up many rocks. They call up the rocks, whatever rocks you would like. But of course, Tom Killian has lent us his image for the front, which is a Sierra image. And this anthology, of course, was edited by our own Lisa Alvarez. It is full of a variety of different kinds of poems, a variety of poems that are written up on the mountain, as well as, you know, in our Zoom community.
And a variety of years too, right? I mean, this is the 50th anniversary anthology, and the poems are from the beginning through now. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. And I love the way the title, Why to These Rocks, gets a kind of question and also an answer in the same phrase. So it's very rich and resonant in that way. I just can't thank Lisa Alvarez enough for having worked so hard to make this collection. It's really beautiful. It cuts across a lot of years, and so I highly recommend it. This, many staff poets are included.
50 years of poetry in a little more than 300 pages. I'm impressed that somebody had the foresight 50 years ago to start collecting these poems, because it would have been very easy to have the weekend and share the poems and everybody goes their separate ways and nobody was keeping a file. But somebody obviously did, to be able to go back and pull these up.
Yes, some of these are very old, and some are much more recent. And Lisa did call through a lot of, a call was sent out. Many people submitted poems, and so, that's how this was done.
The chapters, I want to point out the topics of the chapters, because they are all about poetry. It's poetry about poetry, and it's also poetry about the place where these workshops happen in the Sierra. So there are, and the alliteration is lovely. Poems about the place, poems about process, poems produced by the process in place. So we really get to read in poetic form what these last 50 years have been about for the people who participate. Plus, you've been involved just in the last almost 10 years in the community of writers, but does it give you a picture of who came before you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is something you realize when you go that you're part of something much, much larger. You know, you really are connecting to that history that I was talking about earlier that I'm trying to, or I hope I inspire my students to consider. And when I first went in 2012, I had really questioned whether I was going to write poetry anymore. And I went there and I walked away with 7 drafts of poems that I was really excited about. And I was writing in a way I had never written before. So, and that was because of just the extraordinary people there, the spirit of the place, and the kind of encouragement to, you know, to be a little reckless and try something different and new and innovative, for me at least. Yeah.
Well, that's why people go to the mountains, isn't it? To have that feeling of that energy. But when you're in a collective, when you're truly in a community of writers, you also have that energy of the people and their art coming at you, and that exchange that you have with them, that must be so inspiring.
Well, I was just going to say also one thing to just add and think about is I never thought about this, but it's certainly a method that I've adopted now in a lot of my teaching, that if you have a period in your development of your art or your craft in which you're allowed to generate rather than critique, I think that we all need to learn editing skills for our poems, like really have the courage to throw out the bad lines or the lines, or just say, this draft really was dead in the water. But having a week in which you're not saying that to yourself, you're saying, just generate more, more, more. Bob calls it the adrenaline rush, you know. I'm going to go up to my room and have the adrenaline rush, you know. And just trying to produce rather than critique, and then telling yourself later, I'll go back and use my measured. It's sort of like, first I'm a child and then I can be an adult later. But right now I'm just going to be like play in my playpen and throw stuff around.
So there are no lines to color in. You can color all over the page if you want to. And then what happens when you do go back? You're not critiquing in that moment, in that period of time that you're at the workshop. You're not critiquing. You're just playing, as you've both mentioned. But then, Brenda, you mentioned that in the back of your head, you're saying, oh, I'll work on this a little bit later. When you go back to it later, is it dramatically different?
For me, sometimes not even a single line will be saved. I will go back and rewrite. I'm an obsessive reviser and I love revising. I just copy and copy and copy and copy and copy. And the bad stuff falls out and the good stuff stays. But I feel like we as a community, I'd like to talk a lot about what we do with those drafts. And I've given craft talks in the past about it, like having the courage to actually look at it and say, how do you make that judgment? So there's a lot of skill, I think, in both parts of the act.
Plus, you're a poet and an instructor, and then in the particular case of the community of writers, you've gone from poet to instructor and still writing as a part of that. But what is the difference when you're one of the group writing? It's a little bit different than when you are the instructor and you're trying to guide a little bit. How do you guide freedom and creativity?
I think it is such a unique conference, because I think that the staff, my, you know, I witnessed what the other staff members were doing. They, you know, it really isn't a critique of the poem as much of because these are little seedlings that we've produced, right? So it's really more about pointing out what you're drawn to. Ooh, I really admired this moment, and I like the way this diction shifts here, or this turn is interesting, so that you leave the room with a sense of what's working, and you're not really thinking about what you didn't do right, or how you failed, I'll say that first. And second, I think really it's a matter of just guiding the discussion, because the people there are already really accomplished writers. They're very good, very, very good. And so it is really about community speaking about poetry. People aren't waiting just to hear what the staff member has to say. Everyone's listening to one another. And so it's really just about facilitating that conversation more than kind of, I don't know, guiding the writer, in my opinion.
The leaders within the workshop over the years, as evidenced by the anthology, the people whose work is in the anthology, the two of you, of course, Brenda Hillman and Blas Falconer, and Robert Haas, of course, is in there. Rita Dove, who so many people absolutely love and admire. Devi Lascar, who I interviewed for her novel not too long ago, and I did not realize she was a poet at the time that I was interviewing her until I did a little bit of research. But as I was reading her novel, thinking, this is so poetic. So to find out that really was her first love, well, yeah, of course, that was pretty obvious, wasn't it? Do you find a lot of people, whether instructors or participants, not that you're letting me know there isn't much of a line between those two groups, but do you find a lot of people who are part of the community of writers are already that widely published when they come in?
Since I'm director now, I do supervise. I'm supervising all of the applications. We have an unusual system of application, an unusual application process, in that all the staff poets read some of the applications. So everyone gets some choices. There's a lot of sort of coming together of certain choices. What's amazing is the high quality, and it's very high quality. So it is it's pretty competitive to get in. It always has been. And I want to put in a plug for Brett Hall Jones, because Brett Hall Jones is a genius goddess and beautiful person. And she just supervises this thing all year, as well as our year-round offerings, which we've started to have now. What happens is that people apply from where they are. Some have several books, some have prizes, some have multiple awards, but they want to use the community to sort of recharge their batteries and go up and have a concentrated week in which they can write and write together.
Which is what Blas was saying happened to him. It sounds like that happens with a lot of people. I'm glad you brought up the application process, because you're virtual this year and have been for a couple of years. But whether virtual or in person, it's not something people just drop into because they write poetry. There are applications. There's a selection process. How many people are in the poetry workshop every year?
Just to tag on to what you said, we do hope to have more year-round offerings that'll expand what we are able to do. The staff is small and very hardworking, so we have to go with that. But in terms of number, we used to have 5 staff poets, and so we would have 60 people coming because we try to keep we don't even call them workshops. We call them morning sessions. If we start calling it a workshop, you think, oh, I'm going to start working on that poem. But we try to keep the term to morning sessions. So the sessions are about 12 people, sometimes 13. And so we have about 72. And once you've applied and gotten in, you can return, not at any sort of particular rate of speed now, because there are a lot of people who want to come back, but you can return and buy a lottery. So.
So the anthology is one piece of this, and a piece that I'm glad finally happened after 50 years, what took so long. So that's an important piece of this. But the community of writers has 3 weeks of sessions. The first one is for poetry. After that, fiction. And after that, several together, narrative, nonfiction, and memoir have a week of work together. So those, plus the extra sessions that you're doing virtually, add up to a lot of sharing and a lot of education and a lot of overlap, you've explained, of people and topics.
Yes. And really, we hope for not exactly for a continuing education model, but we really realize that what we offer is unique, and it's much needed, and that people, I mean, just to back to our earlier conversation, I think people are desperate without poetry. However you define that, sometimes it's the literal fact of a poem in a particular language, in a particular style, but people need what the language arts can bring so desperately in their lives. And to be able to write it is such a joy, to be able to learn about it. So we're trying to expand.
So as we go into a reentry period and get to know our world and each other a little bit more, what is it about poetry that will fulfill us?
Well, it's such a great question. I think, you know, I was talking about that poem by Shonda Feldman, and reading it, I felt as if I understood what she was saying, something profound and deeply intimate. I've been in my home for a year, isolated. I want to understand how people are. I want to understand how they, you know, what they think or how they feel about something. So in many ways, though poetry is often read privately, although it's often written in a quiet setting, it has the power to connect us. This is so obvious in many ways when you look online, when you go online and you see people sharing poems with one another when something happens in the world, you know, that people are gravitating to, they're looking for something to understand it. And oftentimes it's a poem that will kind of give insight into something that seems impossible to understand. And, you know, when you see thousands of people, you know, reading a poem that's been shared online, talking about that poem, sharing that poem, liking that poem, you know that it's doing this good work of creating community. So I think that you know, this year, a lot of people have been on, have been attending readings online on Zoom to feel connected and to understand this sometimes incomprehensible world. And I think that's going to continue after, you know, when we're all back out in the world again.
Blas Falconer and Brenda Hillman talking about Why to These Rocks, 50 years of poetry from the community of writers. Our podcast is produced by Jen Picard. Our recording and technical team included James Tejada, Antonio Munoz, and Mark Jones. The executive producer is Joe Barr. Our theme song is from Pond 5. You can find more information about the authors and books at capradio.org/reads or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Donna Epidone. Thanks for listening to Cap Radio Reads from Capital Public Radio.